We were talking before the break just about the relationship of freedom, this concept of the freedom of indifference versus the concept of freedom of excellence, and that for St. Thomas, freedom is really the interaction of the pursuit of truth and the pursuit of goodness working together, right, intellect and will. And that, and we concluded with this whole concept that making similar choices of the same kind eventually builds a habitus in us, which is either a vice or a virtue. We want to distinguish, we want to add another word to that and say what they're called, for St. Thomas, acquired vice or acquired virtue. You've acquired something, all right? You've acquired vice and you acquired virtue. And that's going to be very important for our talk, the second talk today. I want to begin, though, when we talk about this acquiring virtue and vice, simply to say that it's, we all know how difficult this is. It's difficult to become virtuous. It's difficult to live morally. And St. Thomas, when he talks about these things, he's not simply speaking as a philosopher or as an ethicist, even though much of what I spoke of in our last talk really was St. Thomas relying a lot on Aristotle. St. Thomas is first and foremost a man of faith. He's a believer. So it would not be good for me to leave you without some sort of understanding of what role then grace and faith play in the moral life and the virtuous life, and what role they play in helping us to become more free. Precisely because, as I said at the beginning of our time together today, there can be a temptation and a tendency to see all things godly, or to see God as somehow restricting our freedom. I'd love to be able to do this if God just would not deny me this, you know? Then we start making deals with God, right? You let me do this, and then I'll do that, you know, as if that works. For St. Thomas, when we were created, so this is looking back to Adam and Eve, he says that Adam and Eve, before the fall, the word we're going to use here is original justice. Everything getting what is due to it. This word original justice is used primarily in the Catholic tradition to define or to name that state in which Adam and Eve, the original man and woman, lived, according to biblical teaching. Now, I want to refer you at this point, because I know that some of you are asking already in your minds, I want to refer you to the Thomistic Institute podcast on iTunes, to a lecture that was, I want to say, several months ago by Archbishop Augustine de Noia on the relationship between St. Thomas's understanding of original sin and evolution, all right, and scientific evolution. It's about an hour-long lecture. I think it's, I have to say, it's probably one of the best examples of what an authentic, really seasoned and wise theologian of St. Thomas Aquinas ought to be able to do for you.
Is that the lecture sponsored by Magnificat?
No, I don't believe so. No, this was just a lecture at the Dominican House of Studies. But if you look at it, just look for in the Thomistic Institute podcast, if you listen to that. I know they're on Apple iTunes. They might be elsewhere. Katie can maybe mention that at some point if you spot her, our coordinator from the Thomistic Institute. He goes into all of these questions about Adam and Eve, given what contemporary science says an original sin. I'm not going to go into that here. So I'm just going to, let's assume an original man and woman. Biblically, St. Thomas says that they were created, and when they were created, they were endowed with grace and other gifts that surpassed what was due to them. All right, so they had grace and other gifts. It wasn't just them living out their human nature. This is an important point to understand. They weren't just living human nature that was not fallen. They were living human nature with grace and gifts, extra gifts from God. Okay. One of the interesting points Archbishop de Noia points to on this front is that for St. Thomas, there really was never intended from the beginning to be a question in our relationship with God of some distinction between nature and grace. There is now because we're fallen. Right, but that we were created in grace in a certain way. Okay. for St. Thomas, that original justice was a sort of threefold rectitude or submission, which is to say that for St. Thomas, and really for the Catholic tradition at large, man was subjected to God. He was obedient to God. His reason was obedient to God. His pursuit of truth, obedient to God. His lower powers, so his passions and his emotions, were obedient to his higher powers of reason. And the body was obedient to the soul. Okay? So there was, in a certain sense, a virtue already there. You know, when we acquire virtue, I should have said this a little bit earlier, the virtuous person, as I said, is not stoic. The virtuous person is someone who actually feels passion more deeply and purely, because the virtuous person doesn't allow passion and does not fear passion, that it's going to run away with him or he's going to lose control. Right? So the virtuous person is actually more free to experience emotion, sensuality, even irascibility, in a deeply more holistic and pure way. So when you see people who seem to have no feeling, you should not emulate them as virtuous. They're not. But neither is the person who is constantly flying off the handle. But for St. Thomas, Adam and Eve had that. They were obedient to God. Their lower powers, their animal side, their emotional side was obedient to that pursuit of truth and goodness, and the body was obedient to the soul. It would be a mistake to believe that that threefold submission was something that they had acquired or something that was due to them. That's what St. Thomas means by that original grace and gifts of God to Adam and Eve. Right, that's where we should be living. All right, that's really what we're aiming for in the moral life, is what they already had. Okay. Thanks, Adam and Eve. So that's what we're supposed to be living, right? Now, that does not mean, just to draw a distinction here, that does not mean that they had the beatific vision, or that they could see God in himself, right? Which we understand the beatific vision to be, which awaits us, you know, by God's grace, we persevere and we are welcomed into eternity with him, the beatific. But they didn't have that. So the Bible says that they walked with God, but if they had had the beatific vision, St. Thomas is very clear, they would not have sinned. Because the beatific vision is the perfect good. And if you have that, you don't want anything else. It's not that you can't sin. It's that you simply don't want to. You don't want to turn away from it. So they didn't have that. And we know that because, well, they sinned. Right? Okay, so they did not have grace in the sense of like some supernatural thing that made them more than human. But they had grace that made them perfectly human and kept everything in line for them. Okay? That situation was wholly unique. Man was given a wholly unique gift of grace that was not owed to him, but which perfected human nature on a sort of natural level, if you will, because it eliminated some of the deficiencies that are in fact part and parcel of our human nature, which is that our emotional life can run away with us. Right? Because we are malleable, we can find goods in all sorts of other things. Because we are creaturely, we can suffer and we can die. Okay, so all of that gift in the original state was a gift. Not owed, not earned, not part of human nature. It came from God, sort of like extra. Right? The loss of that original sin... I'm sorry, the loss of that original justice through original sin is, of course, defined dogma. As men and women, you and I, who live in the corrupted state of nature, our discussions about grace and nature and morality are always defined by this fact that we now live in a weakened condition. We don't have that great gift of always being focused on God, having our emotional life completely in line, and having our body completely obedient to the soul. St. Thomas was so strong about the body-soul relationship on this front. Okay, read my book. That's all in there about the body-soul. That's another little plug for you. He's so strong about the body and soul relationship. He thinks you're not really a person unless you have a body as a human. He thinks, the body is not incidental. We're going to get to that a little bit more this afternoon. It's not simply the mortal coil waiting to be shed. We are made to have bodies. All right, the soul interacts with the body and through the body. For St. Thomas, that original justice, he never refers to it as a habitus. So it's not a quality. It's an extrinsic sort of gift. Original sin, then, how it comes into play for St. Thomas, is that it is the loss of that great gift of original justice that we now live with. So rather than being endowed with nature-perfecting, harmonizing grace that harmonizes everything for us in this life, that divinely given gift, we're actually now sort of living with a certain quality. St. Thomas never uses the word habitus for original sin either, but he seems to come close. But we live with a certain quality of being, if you will, habitus of being, of being essentially disintegrated. We're not integrated persons. Because our minds can go from God to all sorts of other things. Our passions don't always follow the mind or the reason or the will. And our bodies certainly are not obedient to the soul. Right? As we get older, we learn that more realistically. Right? So, original sin, however, we must understand, is not a pure privation. It's not an absolute privation. It does not, for St. Thomas, nor for the Catholic tradition, destroy the human nature. It weakens it. To call original sin a pure privation would be also to assert that somehow that grace that Adam and Eve were given, was somehow due them or expected of God. Does that make sense? So if that grace, which is what we lose with original sin, if I'm going to say original sin is a privation, it means that that God owed us that grace, that gift. He doesn't. All right. Original sin is not that sort of privation. But because it no longer has that harmony that that gift of God in original justice gave in the primitive state, St. Thomas, the best way to say this is what holds that rather in original sin, what we have now is the continued existence of human nature without the nature perfecting endowments of grace, and that privation, because we do not have grace to keep everything in line, that gift, that inevitably leads to disorder. One of the famous Thomistic commentators of the 20th century, T.C. O'Brien, says this: human nature, with its powers as derived from Adam, is now just left to itself. That's how it's disordered. You're just left to your own devices. Okay. This understanding of original sin is important for two reasons. First, original sin, and I'm going to use this language even though I'm sure all of you or virtually all of you have heard otherwise. Original sin is not a positive inclination to evil that is somehow added to the human nature after the sin of Adam and Eve. All of you, I'm sure, have heard original sin is inclines us to sin or evil, right? Stop anybody you hear who says that. All right? It is not a positive inclination, something that was added on, like given as a punishment to human nature. Because if you say that, if original sin is understood as some as an inclination to sin that was given after the sin of Adam and Eve, then you're implying God is the cause of you being inclined to sin, right? As punishment. Rather, original sin is understood as the rupture of our relationship with God, and therefore the disintegration of our human nature, which the disintegration is what then leads us to sin. We're left to ourselves, to our own devices. The second reason this is important is that it provides the key for understanding St. Thomas's view of fallen human nature and the necessity of grace we now have living the moral life in this world. St. Thomas, like the Catholic tradition before him, speaks of the human nature as essentially wounded. It's wounded because it doesn't have the grace that keeps it in line in which it was created. The grace in which Adam and Eve were created. He says there are, in fact, and I'm going to give you these. He says there are, in fact, three goods of human nature. First, there are the principles of our human nature, the properties, for example, that we have an intellect, that we have will, that we have emotion and passion. He said these are good. These are good things in the human nature. Second, he says the human nature, and this is actually very optimistic, he says we are by nature actually inclined to virtue. You're actually bent towards virtue by nature. Why? Because virtue is the perfection of those powers. And third, he says the third gift, or the third good of human nature, was in fact that gift of original justice that God gave to Adam and Eve. He says only that is what's really lost, absolutely, with Adam and Eve's sin. You still have your powers, intellect, will, passions. He says they're not destroyed. They're still working, however disordered and diminished, you know, they might be. He says, however, the inclination to virtue, which we all ought to have by nature, is radically diminished, precisely because we can no longer naturally and, if to use a, you know, a colloquial word, intuitively understand why, whether or why God is our perfect good. And because the body is no longer obedient to the soul, we no longer have, even we know that, we no longer have carnal, our body no longer keeps up with the spirit. St. Paul talks about this all the time, right? There's a war between the spirit and the flesh. So what that means is, folks, it's harder to be virtuous now than it would have been otherwise. Sorry, moving on to my second. So, when it comes to moving to virtue, and the ground for morality, what we've been speaking about is this idea that somehow morality is grounded in positive law and mere emotion. But as I've said, St. Thomas is not simply an ethicist. He's a believer. He's a man of faith. He believes that it's only by faith that we can know not only that there is a good out there that is our perfect happiness and not our imperfect happiness, but that that this good is, in fact, the God of Jesus Christ, three divine persons, who has come to us, who was incarnate, suffered, died, and rose to establish a new covenant in his blood and to give us the gift of his grace through the power of the Holy Spirit. And so now, with faith and grace, what Christ has revealed, in St. Thomas's view, is a higher call or a higher goal, a higher end for the human person. Because now it is revealed that not simply marriage or not even simply pursuing truth for its own sake or love for its own sake. Now we know that perhaps on the natural level that works, but in fact on the supernatural level we have a higher good. We have a higher goal, and that's to be with God, to be united to him perfectly. Right. This is something that is only known by grace. Specifically by the grace of faith. And because grace is absolutely unmerited, this knowledge is not something that we can acquire or achieve. So even if you are disposed to believe because you grew up in a family that was believers, or even if you're a very intelligent person and you can understand St. Thomas's five proofs for the existence of God, which he says very few people can. You cannot know that God is a personal God who loves you and wants to be united to you in a very profound, deep way unless he has given that to you to know through the grace of faith. You can't prove yourself into it. You have to have the grace of faith. You say, well, you know, Father, I spent some time in my teenage years investigating all of these religions, and I came to believe Christianity was true. I said, well, yes, you did. Fine, good. But you only came to that conclusion because you had the grace, because God gave you the grace of faith. Right? John Henry, Cardinal Newman, speaks about an illative sense, that we can have all sorts of things, reasons for believing and pointing upwards, but until God gives you that grace of faith, you will not have it. And you can't earn it. Okay. That really goes against our grain, but it's absolutely unearned, unmerited. It's grace, period. And what revelation, what faith, the grace of faith and revelation, you know, manifested, articulated, both in Scripture and then in the teaching of the Church, what revelation teaches us is that the vision of God, to which we are called, union with him, surpasses all that we can do and all that we can achieve, even if we have acquired virtue. You can be the most virtuous person in the world. And if you do not have the grace of faith, you will not believe. And if God does not deign to give you the grace of perseverance, you will not be saved. And there's nothing, and I want to say this if you're not getting the point here, there's not a darn thing you can do about it. Okay? It is unearned and unmerited. St. Thomas is quite clear about this. That in fact the supernatural end that God has designed for human nature, it is not contrary to our nature, but it exceeds our nature. We have a capacity for it, which means made in the image of God, being thinking, choosing, loving persons that we are, we have a capacity to enjoy knowing God and loving God. But that capacity cannot be fulfilled without his help, which is grace. Grace is for us a mysterious thing. As I said, it's utterly gratuitous, but nonetheless, for St. Thomas, and this is, there's a lot of writing going on about this right now in the field. I would refer you to anything written by Father Thomas Joseph White, the director of the Thomistic Institute. See, I keep doing that. there's a lot of great things going on about the relationship in Thomas between freedom and grace, between God's will for salvation and our interaction with that will, you know. So I can't go into all of that here, obviously, but I do want to say that grace, and you're going to see how a little bit in a minute, we believe that grace is a gift from God that nonetheless interacts with our freedom. It doesn't override our freedom, but on the contrary, it elevates our freedom. And it empowers us to cooperate with God in our own sanctification and in the sanctification of the world. So when we're living in grace, we do not simply become God's puppets. All right? The Blessed Mother, who had grace in spades, could have said no. She was free to. She didn't. She freely said yes, not because she was forced, but because she simply, in the grace God gave her, did not see any other good worthy to be chosen but to say yes. So she could not say no because she would not say no, not the other way around. All right. So grace interacts with our freedom, because if it doesn't, if it overrides it, in St. Thomas's view, then it destroys us. It destroys our nature. Because the great gift God gave to humanity is the gift of knowledge and will, intellect and will. And if grace were to override that, he would be taking back his greatest gift, you see. Grace is a quality. I said earlier, for St. Thomas, grace is a habitus. It's a habitus of being. It's a real quality of the soul. So it's not like a virtue, but it's like health. And that's a good way to think about grace. It's like a spiritual health. If you're living in grace, you're living with spiritual health. Grace is a hidden thing. It cannot be felt. St. Thomas is absolutely clear about this. Living in a culture as we do that prizes emotional connection, even those in the church who are devout and really practicing believers can easily and understandably come to believe that grace is a feeling, that I have it when I feel it and I don't when I don't feel it, that it's an emotional sensation. I need to tell you, this is very dangerous, believing that. It's incredibly dangerous. I was born in 1978, I would say, so my generation, I would say the generation of many of the young in this room, it's starting to turn. We were all catechized by a generation of catechists who were catechized with the Baltimore Catechism in the 50s and then the 60s, and somewhere in the late 60s and early 70s started to believe that what was missing was an emotional connection with Jesus Christ, right? So all I got in catechism was Jesus loves you, emotional connection, and really no substance, right? In high school, going on youth retreats where by Friday night, they would have all of us in tears for how bad we were and emotionally, you know, destroyed. On Saturday, we would be all zealous and ready to, you know, rebuild ourselves because we had, you know, come to Jesus. And then on Sunday, we were sent out, and on Monday, it was like none of it ever happened. The moment you begin to believe that grace is merely emotion, or that you don't have it because you're not feeling it, is the moment you begin to move away from the faith when times are tough. The lives of the saints are very clear about this. Sometimes, yes, God does send the grace of consolation. Sometimes he does console you and embrace you when you need it. But those are often relatively few times in one's spiritual life. Grace is unfelt. I want to tell you that the Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 2005, explicitly says this. It escapes our sense experience. You don't feel it. How can you know you have it? Well, the Catechism and St. Thomas says, well, there can be some, he said, St. Thomas says you can't know it unless Jesus Christ himself appears to you and tells you you have it. Then you can be certain you got it, right? But if you, there can be signs, like you don't hate to pray. You know, you don't hate going to Mass. I mean, you're not conscious. A big sign you don't have it is your conscience of having committed a mortal sin. Then you definitely don't have it. You need to go to confession and get it back, right? So grace is not felt. The Holy Spirit, the third person of the Trinity, the source of grace in the life of the church and in the soul of believers, is a very is probably of the three persons of the Trinity the most discreet of the three persons. The Holy Spirit very rarely calls attention to himself. He brings you to Jesus Christ and assimilates you to him. When it comes to the grace of faith by which God is not only revealed, but by which we give our assent to him, so grace of faith not only reveals God to us, but also helps us to say yes. All right? So that's an important, gosh, you cannot even say yes to God without him helping you to do so. All right? The grace of faith not only reveals him, but helps you to assent to him. There's no explanation, and there are several books I can recommend to talk more about this if you're interested in it, but there is absolutely no explanation that we can give of why one person receives the grace of faith while another does not. There's no explanation, I'm going to get into this a little bit more, of why some people faith seems to come easier and others not. What we do know, it has nothing to do with them. St. Paul, 1 Corinthians 4:7. What have you that you have not received? What distinguishes you from one from another? But that does not mean, let me just say this. This is also why infant baptism is so important for us. Because that baby at his baptism is infused with the grace of faith. Now, they still have to sort of grow in that grace and eventually accept it. But that baby doesn't know what's going on. There's no acceptance of that at the moment of baptism. It's given the grace of faith right there at the baptism. That's why, you know, when parents are suffering and children going wayward and lapsed, I always say, baptize? Okay, God will work it out. Grace was given. Okay, you have to trust that. Dominicans are big on this. This is a big point for us. We're St. Dominic, preacher of grace. Now, this does not mean, however, that God is bound to offer grace to everyone. He's not bound to do anything by our actions. However, and this is where we're going to get into this a little bit more, there are certain preparations that a person can make to be more docile to the grace of faith when it comes, to the graces of God when they come, like living a virtuous life and humbly seeking truth. We might even say that there are preparations in people's lives that transcend and predate even the individual. So, for example, the families in which we are raised. Some families, it's easier to be docile to grace than other families in which we're raised. Some of us have very dramatic conversion stories that despite the families of origin where we come from, somehow we found our way, you know, faith found us, grace found us, and we're living radically different lives than most everybody else in our family. Right? So that's not a guarantee, right? So, but that can be a way in which our dispositions to receive grace can be cultivated, if you will, by the kinds of choices we make. The families in which we were raised, their history, like how they ended up in this country or that country, in this town or that town, and what this town taught me when I was growing up. All of that helps me become who I am in relation to God and my own character. The attitudes of my parents towards the faith, the friends we find ourselves with, for good or ill. Now here's the thing. You don't choose that either. None of that's your choice. You don't choose the families you were raised in or how they ended up in little small town America or in upstate New York. You don't choose that. So even before the reception of the grace of our faith, St. Thomas says even the preparations, like if we're like in this long life of preparation, never really believing, and we get to our deathbed and we finally believe, all of that, St. Thomas, was a preparation for that moment. All of it was, in fact, also beyond your choice. You're just sort of blindly going through. So why do some families or some people seem better prepared or more docile to faith, more naturally suited to it than others? Well, God is the sower, and he prepares the ground for the seed. Some people are just better prepared. They might be families. It might be how they're raised, where they're raised. It might even come down to something as simple as bodily chemistry and disposition. I tend to be a person, I'm not saying I do, I'm saying one tends to be a person who likes to sit in the quiet. That person, once that person has the grace of faith, is probably going to be a person who likes to pray more than the next believer. Right? So that's when we say, I mean, how many ways are there to salvation? Well, there's only one way, Jesus Christ, but there's as many ways to get to Jesus Christ as there are human beings with all these dispositions. This is our Christian life. Now, once we're in grace, once we are in grace, the things we do cooperating in grace, this is a new relationship with God in which Christ comes to live within. This is St. Paul. It's no longer my life, I who live, but Christ who lives in me. So for the believer who's living in grace, morality now is no longer simply a natural matter of pursuing goodness and truth. Morality now exists at a higher pitch or at a higher key. Pope Benedict XVI, in his first encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, in the very beginning, says that for the Christian is set on a different horizon. And so the Christian's life takes a different moral cue. Because now it's no longer simply about being virtuous and good. It's about being united to Jesus Christ and allowing him to act in grace and cooperating with his grace to act in and through us. And so he becomes that around which the Christian life revolves. It creates a new relationship with God that is in fact brought to life by the grace of charity. So grace, which heals and elevates our nature, is more than a disposition. For St. Thomas, grace is in the very essence of the soul itself, whereby the rational creature and his Lord are in a very intimate relationship. And when that relationship is alive, which is to say when you're living in grace, it's charged or catalyzed by the theological virtue of charity, which St. Thomas identifies as friendship with God, not Hallmark card friendship. True, deep, and abiding friendship whereby God's good becomes my good and my good becomes his. It becomes mutual. So the relationship with God, which is brought about by grace, corresponds then to our pursuit of supernatural happiness, which we can obtain by the power of God, which in the second letter of St. Peter, one of St. Thomas's favorite passages, 2 Peter 1:4, whereby we in Christ are made partakers in the divine nature itself. In God's own nature, we become sharers. So, for St. Thomas then, grace brings with it three important virtues. The virtue of faith, by which we believe God and assent to God, and then another talk would be how all that gets concretized or gets structured by instruction and teachings. But faith is first and foremost believing God and assenting to God. The virtue of hope, which exists in the will, by which I adhere to God and his promises in spite often of evidence to the contrary. And the virtue of charity, by which I am already united to God in this life. I'm united to God in charity. And it's in my will. So in charity, I begin then, and this is where we get back to love. In charity, in the will, the love of God, even though it's not that, even though I'm still struggling with that body, soul, my body being obedient to my soul, my emotions sometimes running away with me, if I'm living in charity, so I haven't committed any mortal sins that I'm conscious of or know of, my will has a charity, which is an infused love of God, and through that, an infused love of neighbor. And this, friends, is the only way by which we can love God as he deserves to be loved, which is to say, to love him with the grace of his love, which is given to us, rather than our weak, fickle human love. Now, for Aquinas, that love, that charity, then begins to order all the other things we love, sometimes very slowly. So in the spiritual life, we slowly come to know God in faith, hope in his promises, and then grow in love of him through charity. In time, and this is sort of level one of the spiritual life for Aquinas, we then slowly root out of our lives those actions and choices that remove that charity from us, so mortal sins. So for St. Thomas, it's possible to get through life in grace without committing a mortal sin. He says that. The bad news is you can't get rid of venial sins, because venial sins occur precisely because your body often gets in the way of things. You're tired, you're weak, you're impatient, your emotional life. And that's part of the body. That's not going to be fixed until the resurrection. All right. So bad news and good news. Right. Now, for St. Thomas, and this I need to tell you, I want to tell you that here St. Thomas is somewhat unique. And this is not in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. All right. It's not heresy, but there are theological developments that have not yet risen to the level of dogma. Okay? This is one of them. And it's a classic scholastic dispute. But this is I'm giving you St. Thomas's view because I think it's right. Right. For St. Thomas, then, because grace, and we're living and cooperating in grace in our lives, the idea that we often have is that grace is somehow extrinsic or exterior. There's what I'm doing and there's what God's doing in me or through me. Does that make sense? Like the analogy I often use with people, it's like the Energizer battery. Like grace is this battery God puts into me and I just run off with it, you know? That's not Aquinas' view of grace. All right. Grace is not I do this, then God does this, and then I go for, you know, it's not me like leapfrogging with God. All right. When I have grace and I'm living in grace, everything good that I do, or at least everything that's not sinful, I'm doing within and through God. Everything. Within and through God. So for St. Thomas, that can in fact merit me more grace. I can actually earn more grace that way. But it's not me who's earning it. It's the merits of Jesus Christ with whom I am cooperating in my good actions. Okay? Now that is dogma. All right, I'm getting to the sketchy part in a minute. Yeah, that is dogma. Now, that's all permeating. Now, what role does virtue have in this regard to this? Well, for St. Thomas, the acquired virtues, prudence, justice, temperance, fortitude, and the rest, are insufficient to help you live the spiritual life. They can help you be a good citizen, they can help you be a good neighbor, but they're insufficient to help you live the spiritual life. So for St. Thomas, when you have grace, when you have the theological virtue of charity, he proposes that there is in fact such a thing as infused moral virtues. So if you're living in grace, you're given a whole set of virtues as a gift, unearned, unacquired by God. Infused prudence, infused temperance, infused fortitude, and infused justice. All right? And what he means by this is that precisely because we are malleable creatures, grace is molding us to live our lives in this world as Christians in a just, prudent, temperate, and courageous way, but at a higher key because we're living in grace. All right? So, a classic example. You can have, let me back continue on this line for a minute. That's why we have infused virtue for St. Thomas. So you can, in fact, not yet have acquired prudence, like on worldly things, like you still may not be very good at having those difficult conversations. But if you're living in grace, you've got infused prudence. And you're like, well, what good is that if I can't have the difficult conversations? Well, because the infused virtues, first and foremost, are about your life with God. You say, so what is it prudent to ask God for? and when to ask him. You see? And then in time, this will also bleed into, if I can put it this way, your sort of natural life. St. Thomas is unique on this. Others in his age would say that, well, no, there are, when you have to first get the acquired virtues and then grace will build on top of those. St. Thomas says, no, absolutely not. You could actually not have any of the acquired virtues and have infused virtue. That's how radical the gift is of God in grace. And it's because for St. Thomas, the necessity of infused virtue is located in the fact that grace is supposed to permeate every aspect of our lives. Now, I don't want to get into too much of the weeds here. I do want to say a little bit more about the difference between acquired virtue and acquired vice and infused virtue. When you have acquired virtue, let's use the acquired virtue of temperance. Acquired virtue of temperance allows you to be temperate in the sensual desires you have, the sensual delights you take, the things you take sensual delight in. Think of the virtues of sobriety, virtues of fasting, abstinence. When you get those virtues, virtue of chastity, when you get all under temperance, when you get those virtues, well, you do it pretty easily. You're not struggling with it anymore. Chastity is how you know, like the person who's St. Augustine's famous phrase, Lord, make me chaste, but not yet, right? St. Thomas would say he's on his way. He's not quite there yet. He's at this level of just continence, you know, which is he's basically trying to be chaste, but he hates it, you know, not yet there at the virtue, okay? But when you get the virtue, you do it easily. It's not even a problem. Right? And some people, especially on matters of temperance, going back to emotional dispositions, some people on matters of temperance will get some better than others. You know, St. Thomas always had this belief that when it came to drink, sex, and food, most of us have trouble with one and not the other two. And for each of us, it's different. Like some people, sex is not really a temptation, but food is. You know, okay. So I've got acquired temperance. I'm chaste generally. I like it. I'm easy. It's easy. Comes by easily. But let's say you have someone who's not, like a St. Augustine. But he's got grace. So he has infused temperance. So for St. Thomas, when you have infused temperance, the bad news is it doesn't mean all of a sudden your moral life becomes easier. It just means that you're going to be temperate for reasons that are at a higher level, a graced level. Right? So for instance, if I'm a believer, I'm going to be temperate in my sensual desires and my sensual delights, not simply because I recognize that they're not good for me, but because I know that this is what God has asked of me and he's given me the grace to do it. I still may struggle with it. So they give St. Thomas says initially infused, but yeah, they don't give you necessarily the facility. But here's the thing. As you live in infused virtue and you're doing it for reasons of divine, it actually can help you then build up the acquired virtue as well. So that you do get more facility. It becomes easier. One of the more recent examples, the name I'm blanking, Irishman, help me out here. Matthew Talbot, yeah. Is he venerable or blessed now? Is he blessed? He's a classic example, Blessed Matthew Talbot. How many know Blessed Matthew Talbot? He's like a patron now for drunkards, right, for alcoholics. So he basically was not living the life of faith and then was given like a conversion moment and made a vow to a priest, like a personal vow to a priest, that he would just never drink again. At that moment, came to believe in Jesus Christ, boom, making this vow. That's what we call infused temperance. He testified the rest of his life, he still had difficulty never walking into a pub or never walking into a liquor store. So his whole life, never touched a drop, infused temperance. Why? Because he knew that's what God was asking. You see? And he was able to do it. Was it easy? No, because he hadn't acquired the temperance. Now, towards the end, I think probably he was getting it, but some of us, the carnal dispositions are strong. Right? Now, the sort of, and this, I'm going to conclude with this, the sort of upshot of all of this is the relationship of infused virtue to acquired vice. And this is where I want to give you some hope. I get this as a confessor all the time. People will come in and confess to me, Father, I have a vice. And, and let's just be honest, it's often vices of a sexual nature, right? But then they're coming to confession. You see, by definition, an acquired vice means that I do it easily without even thinking about it. And often, just like an acquired virtue, often I don't even justify it anymore. I become callous to it. So, on one hand, you have to ask, if it's really a vice, why are you even coming to confess? You wouldn't be coming to confession if it were a true vice, if it were that deep. Does that make sense? Because there's not a justification. Okay. But I never say that. I don't want to give anybody excuses, My father says it's not a vice yet, it's... but for St. Thomas, you cannot have an acquired vice and acquired virtue at the same time. The opposites. You can't have acquired temperance and acquired lust at the same time. Precisely because the actions and the choices you have to choose to get one or the other completely contradict each other. See the point? So the interesting question for St. Thomas is, can you have acquired a vice, let's say the vice of lust, and have an infused virtue of temperance? We know you haven't acquired temperance, you got a vice of lust. So what happens? Can you have that and infuse temperance? What do you think St. Thomas's answer is? Yes, absolutely. That's the power of grace. Right? So for St. Thomas, and we believe, of course, as Catholics, that even the moment of wanting to go to confession is itself a moment of grace. Right? So you're not necessarily yet back in charity, but you would not have repentance without some movement of God. Right? You should always be thankful for that. Right? So you stop being thankful, you stop being repentant, you got a problem. All right. So St. Thomas says when grace comes in, it not only infuses faith, hope, and charity and all these infused moral virtues, because grace then takes over really all of our life that we're cooperating with. He says it destroys all acquired vice. All of them. You cannot have any acquired vices when you're living in grace. And then you say, well, I sort of still struggle habitually with all sorts of problems that seem rather vice-laden. And that's where St. Thomas says, you don't have the acquired vice, what you have is a very strong bodily disposition. Your chemistry is inclined to it. But then he says, in a moment of hope, but even that is in the process of being destroyed by grace. That negative carnal disposition. So this is why in the spiritual life, I said, you're not living in mortal sin. You can get past mortal sin by grace, but you might have venial sins, because that venial sins come from those carnal dispositions. Your spiritual life is a constant, our spiritual life is a constant movement from working with God, confession, receiving grace, slowly changing by the infused virtues, and slowly changing our actions, and then acquiring the opposite virtues of the vices that or the dispositions we have. Am I making sense? And moving from one to the other as you succeed by God's grace in the spiritual life. St. Thomas says, these venial sins, he says, sorry, they're always going to be popping up. And what's going to happen is you're going to focus on one. Maybe the venial sin of overindulgence in food, that's my word. But then he says, well, while you're doing that, vainglory is popping up behind you. You know, because you're proud of how well you're doing on your diets and fasting and abstaining. So then you become vainglorious. Then you got to go work on that. You know. So this is our life. It's our life of constantly just popping. You know, it's like whack-a-mole. You know. So that's the good news, friends. It's a life of whack-a-mole, but it's a life in which God's grace overrides and destroys the acquired vices we have, and you should have confidence in that. Even if you still live with a carnal disposition, when you're living in grace, provided you're not committing mortal sins, you're just going to have to keep asking God to strengthen your infused virtues, help you to grow in the acquired virtues in these little shadows of your life, so that you can love him more fully, more honorably, and love well, and more excellently. And that's how you're more free. That's how you avoid the situation of St. Paul in which you see the good, but you're unable to do the good. That's how you become a person who actually sees the good and takes delight in doing the good. And that will be the end of the second conference. Thank you for having me. Amazing.